Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be here before you. I think I once spoke to you about 30 years ago, and so it's great to be back. I'd like to talk today here about what is to be done in the realm of foreign policy concerning anti-Americanism abroad. And I'll begin just by saying that, reviewing very quickly some of the main points that were cited yesterday. Did you say louder?
Yes, please.
Okay. I may have to pick up...
I'll hold up the mic.
No, I'll do it this way. How's that? Can you hear me better? Okay. I want to just review briefly some of the points that were made yesterday concerning the sources of anti-Americanism. One of them, of course, was the general ideological antipathy to Americanism and to morally ordered liberty that we've seen from the Marxists and some of their cousins. Kim Holmes reminded us about how there is such a thing as European elite resentment of U.S. power and perhaps also condescension towards American culture. Richard Pipes made one point which many of us forget, and that is the pandemic ignorance about America in many parts of the world, and we see that very much alive today in a number of places. About which I will comment later. Bob Riley discussed the profound issue of the moral critique made by Muslims against the United States and our secular popular culture, their anger at the phenomena of globalism, and how American culture is involved in destroying their society. And by the way, I should mention that it isn't just a Muslim animus. There are a number of different countries around the world that have had problems with our popular culture. I'm reminded about how our friends in South Korea decided to restrict the ability of the American Forces radio and television network, which was being piped in to our armed forces stationed in Korea, precisely. Because they thought that so many of the products that were they're coming over American television were subversive of their traditional values. Of course, the issues about which everybody has been, so many of these people abroad have been concerned, have to do with sexual libertinism, gay rights issues, feminism, abortion, and so on and so forth. Now, finally, I want to make one point here, and that is that although it was downplayed yesterday, I believe that there is no denying that that opposition to many American policies does play an important role in anti-Americanism abroad. Let's remember, after 9/11, the whole world was on our side. The Europeans were saying, we're all Americans now. There was remarkable sympathy. There was absolutely no questioning the justice of our intervention into Afghanistan. But all of a sudden, the decision not simply to punish Saddam, and there are ways of punishing somebody without having to invade, occupy, and engaging in social revolutionary utopian nation-building exercises. That turned the tide and yielded, in my view, the greatest anti-Americanism that this country has suffered in the history of the Republic, even greater than during the Vietnam War, when the entire international communist apparatus was arrayed against us. This is not to say that Saddam was not a problem, but so were the Barbary pirates, so were all sorts of other miscreants around the world. The Barbary pirates were the Islamist extremists of their day, and Thomas Jefferson did not send Stephen Decatur and the privateers and the Marines to the shores of Tripoli to invade, occupy, and democratize the Barbary pirates. He sent them there on a behavior modification operation. Let me remind you that although we had a coalition of the willing during the Iraq War, our foreign policy failed to persuade the public of any one of those countries to support our war effort in Iraq. And I will go to some of the most congenitally pro-American countries in the world. Let's take the land of my own ancestors, which is Poland. I have a theorem. It's the Lenchovsky theorem. And that is that if you can't get the Polish public to support your foreign policy, you better go back to the drawing board. Now, while all of Bob Riley's points about Islamic leaders and their critique of America are correct, I would like to just point out that not all Muslims in the world share the same fundamental moral critique of the United States. Most Muslims in the world do not want to live under Sharia law, and to date, the only serious Sharia operations that have been going on in the world were the Taliban's government, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. We're seeing the rise of Islamist movements, and there's no denying what has happened in Egypt. There's no denying what can emerge in some of these so-called Arab Spring revolutions elsewhere, and what may emerge in Syria. But this is something which, and it is something that is a matter of huge concern. But nevertheless, most of these movements, in my view, are motivated not so much by a religious and moral critique. Most of Islamism is motivated by political passion, and that is, and there's a serious distinction that has to be made there. The fact is that that U.S. sanctions against Iraq produced a lot of bad press for the United States throughout the Muslim world. Our sanctions were extremely harmful to the Iraqi people, and particularly to Iraqi children, where the low estimate is that something like 100,000 Iraqi children died as a result of malnutrition directly related to our sanctions. And that the high estimate is that 1 million died as a result of those sanctions. And this one fact was one of the greatest pieces of evidence that Al-Qaeda used in its recruitment operations. Those of us who are in the business of teaching integrated strategy like to remind our authorities that when you're engaging in such things as economic sanctions, you have to integrate that with public diplomacy and think about whether you want to hurt innocent people who are actually not your targets. Our military involvement, of course, and the perception of our cultural imperialism in the Arab world has been a huge source of this political animus. And this was, of course, under conditions where, during the Iraq War, the United States did not enjoy an unambiguous casus belli. There were questions raised about the justice of the war by people who are as pro-American as you can imagine, and unfortunately, this all contributed to the inflammation of anti-Americanism both in the Arab world, the extended Muslim world, and elsewhere. Now, a number of these, the combination of these many factors, has been breeding extremism and ultimately terrorism. The problem is that the U.S. government has treated the rise of terrorism principally as a military and an intelligence problem. And it is as if we're going around shooting mosquitoes with shotguns. And you can sure shoot a lot of mosquitoes if you've got enough people there on the ground with a lot of ordnance. But the problem is that there is a fever swamp. And within that fever swamp, you've got the recruitment process of new terrorists. And this is a political, a propaganda, an ideological and a religious doctrines problem. It is the war of ideas. It is the war of propaganda and counter-propaganda. And we essentially are absent from this aspect of the war. The question is, you know, how do we respond? How do we respond to this whole combination of things? The answer is through strategic public diplomacy. And it is something that we have neglected for a very long time. The neglect started in the mid-1960s. It proceeded throughout the 70s. During the Reagan years, we revived it in a very big way. Then it's been neglected ever since Ronald Reagan. The U.S. Information Agency, which was the lead institutional organ that was dealing with this business, was shut down in 1999. A shadow of its former capabilities were folded into the State Department, and the State Department has absolutely no incentive to be good with public diplomacy. And what is public diplomacy? It is relations with and influence over people and opinion leaders and foreign influentials. It is not just relations with governments, which is what traditional diplomacy is. We are completely AWOL when it comes to public diplomacy. The first thing we have to do, of course, is fight the war of ideas. That's not necessarily going to solve all the problems of ideological anti-Americanism. It's the most difficult thing to do, but no agency of the U.S. government is doing it. We are in a war of ideas, as President Bush said, but there are no warriors in that war. The only place that you might see it by accident is there may be some people in one or another of our international broadcasters, like the Voice of America or one of the other radio services, all of which are under major assault right now in the current administration. Last year, the administration tried to shut down all broadcasts by the Voice of America to China. Imagine. They wanted to shut down all broadcasts to China by shortwave and by satellite television broadcasting in favor of the Internet. This is to save $8 million. $8 million? $8 million, that's with an M. That's the amount of money that fell out of the hole in the pocket of a private in the Anbar province in 2007. And yet they want to shut this down. Now they're trying to shut down the Cantonese service. They're trying to decimate the Tibetan service. This is after they've shut down the Russian service, Portuguese to Brazil, and Hindi, as well as decimating the Central English broadcasts over the Voice of America. The problem in our U.S. government is utter illiteracy about ideas, about ideologies, about religion. There is an absence of knowledge about American founding principles. I can regale you with stories about this. And not to mention Western Greco-Roman Judeo-Christian moral philosophy. Warriors of ideas can be hired, and they can be deployed. We did it during the Cold War. The CIA covertly sponsored journals of opinion in many countries around the world, where people writing for them and even some of their editors were unaware of the sources of their support. And yet there was a vehicle whereby serious people of ideas could go out there and compete and prevent such things as the rise of communism in so many places in Europe. We can teach the world about America. Information policy. The Voice of America. We can have visitors programs. We have them, but they could be much bigger than they are to bring people from abroad to the United States. We can have exchanges. People think this is a lot of fluff. It's not. Exchanges and visitors programs and these other things involve establishing personal relationships. Personal friendships, the development of relationships of trust, are what I call and offensive, preemptive counter-propaganda operations. There are education programs. We need also to be able to study foreign propaganda and understand how perceptions management operations are being done against the United States by governments that are actively trying to promote anti-Americanism. In the moral realm, we can do a number of things. Cultural diplomacy. Cultural diplomacy is strategic. During the Cold War, the Soviets invested more in anti-American propaganda in the Indian subcontinent than any place else. We sent the Princeton Choir to New Delhi, and its effect was the political effect of a tactical nuclear weapon. The image of the United States in the Indian mind, a very religious country, was that we were secular, materialist, rapacious, exploitative, greedy, aggressive imperialists. The very presence of this choir and singing beautiful music just destroyed all of that. It reflected the existence of an aesthetic sensibility in the American heart that, and as Chesterton said, art is a reflection of the soul, and the great philosophers have told us about the relationship between beauty, truth, and goodness. All of a sudden, the Indians who witnessed this thought, well, perhaps there is something of a higher order in the American soul. And cultural diplomacy ends up breaking down the barriers that people erect to prevent themselves from listening to messages from sources that they do not trust. Cultural diplomacy is strategic. They talk about hard power and soft power in Washington. We don't have a soft power culture at all. We have a hard power culture and a diplomatic culture, and nobody practically, except maybe the army, is serious about soft power. It's amazing. Finally, we can do some things like interreligious dialogue and exchanges. The U.S. government doesn't touch this business. The only people who are doing it, and perhaps only in a tiny bit, are U.S. military chaplains who have been given the task of informing their combatant commanders about the political, religious, cultural environment in which our troops are fighting. And sometimes the interreligious dialogue between those chaplains and local imams have produced peace in local regions, for example, in Afghanistan, that might have required a lot of blood and treasure to try to achieve otherwise. There are all sorts of things that can be done in interreligious dialogue, including serious philosophical discussions about the nature of God, whether Allah is reasonable, whether Allah is in fact merciful if Allah wills cholera epidemics in Calcutta and the rape of 13-year-olds in Central Africa. We can do much more to argue for human rights, human dignity, and love of neighbor in order to seize the moral high ground. Then we can do aid programs. And forgive me, I know I've got to stop here, but aid programs are incredibly cheap in relationship to what we otherwise would spend our money on, which we have proven to be spending, which is on armed force. And aid programs are, again, proactive and preventive foreign policy that are designed to avoid the damaging effects of hatred and to avoid the high costs of military intervention. We have a friend who learned counterinsurgency aid programs at the lap of General Lansdale, Al Santoli. Some of you may know him. He is successfully defusing anti-Americanism and successful Al-Qaeda recruitment efforts in the poverty-stricken villages of the southern Philippines, where one of Osama bin Laden's wives comes from. And he's doing it by treating people there with dignity, helping them with medical assistance, with education aid, and he does it on almost no budget. This could be done by people, by NGOs, with some very strategic deployment of American aid monies, rather than having bureaucrats go and do the job. Anyway, the prerequisite for all of this is cultural intelligence, knowledge about the circumstances on the ground in these different places. And I think I'd better stop because I just should say, all of this is cheap compared to the other ways we end up spending our foreign affairs and national security monies. Thank you.
Oh, okay. John, thank you very much. Mike Maybaum?
John's board. I'm right.
Who put these up here like that? John's sort of a show-off. Good morning. It's a real honor to be here. I've been coming on and off to Philadelphia Society for 20 years, and it's such an honor, Bill and Julie, to be with you, and congratulations. I've spent over a year, the last 9 years, in Europe. It's a lot of chocolate in Brussels, as you can imagine, and on reflection, I've changed my speech yesterday because I think that we can't change Europe. It'd be nice if they liked us. It's important that they respect us and that they learn from our leadership. I think the best remedy for anti-Americanism is for us to be more American. And I'd like to give you four thoughts about that. At the outset, I just want to remind us that I think the only thing that we didn't hear yesterday, perhaps, about why there's anti-Americanism is because we're really the real revolutionary on the planet. We had a war of independence against a king when the whole world was run by kings, and we were successful. We published the most revolutionary document in human history when the Declaration of Independence said we get our rights not from the king, but from our creator. There's nothing better that's been written about freedom since then. We have the first and oldest constitution. Our constitution is 100 years older than the Italian constitution. George Washington left office on his own volition, and King George was commenting he'll be the greatest man in history if he leaves office voluntarily. Upon conquering other nations, we helped them and set them free. And we've had radical inventions: the atomic bomb, Morse's telegraph, the telephone, mass industrial production, Henry Ford, the television, space travel, the transistor, the integrated circuit. I worked for 18 years at Intel, and I was assistant to the inventor of the integrated circuit, Robert Noyce. The personal computer, the internet, social media, and we put on our money in God We Trust. And the rest of the sentence is, and not the king. We are the real revolutionary. It's one of the reasons why we're not always popular. So I have four recommendations for our response to anti-Americanism. And they're in line with Mr. Regney's excellent article in ISI's publication right outside on the pillars of American conservatism. And I'm going to mention Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, London, and Philadelphia. The first recommendation is that we must keep the faith. Judaism gave us the idea of monotheistic God as well as natural law, and God is the source of order and justice. By recognizing God, one acknowledges that man does not possess all wisdom and owes his existence to a higher power. The humility involved in faith creates a mindset for governmental service and government's true role. And so our first task as conservatives is to be faith-filled people and govern our lives and our nation in this spirit. Now, this is a very personal decision and path. It's demanding, it's never-ending, like T.S. Eliot's poem last night, and government must only allow it, not require it, which is part of American exceptionalism. Second is, we must privatize our educational system. The idea of universal education is fundamental. The value and wisdom of government doing the education of our children has passed. In Athens, the city of Plato and Aristotle, we received the core ideals about ethics, politics, and science, and about how to live a good life and examine life. Ethics establishes character, and education builds culture. The story of Socrates reminds us how vital to every society is the education of the youth. Moreover, as we've moved from the machine age to the information age, one's success as a citizen rests much more on the quality of education than the strengths of your arms and legs, as in the machine age. I live in Alexandria, Virginia. 60% of the children, K through 12, in my city go to private schools. And we have the state's only formally declared failed high school. We have a president who says he's for public education, but his two daughters go to the most expensive school in my community. Today we bemoan, and our president bemoans, the growing income gap and a shrinking of the middle class, which will only worsen absent equalizing educational opportunity. This change is the single most important thing we can make after our faith. Next, we must radically renew American federalism. Rome taught us that the best and highest form of government is the republic, a republic that provides separation of powers, checks and balances, the division of governmental focus we call federalism. And London gave us the Magna Carta and reminded us about the rule of law, which is what our founders gave us, and that's why we're in Philadelphia today. These men in Philadelphia used those lessons from Rome and from London to do the hardest thing known to man, and that is create a free and prosperous society based on laws and not men. But today, Washington is torn by debates the founders never meant to occur in Washington. The founders designed a national government to look outward, foreign policy and trade. And the states and localities were designed to look inward toward the people. But our president today spends most of his time talking about education, healthcare, reproductive rights, redistribution of wealth, and shovel-ready highway jobs. He is not the governor of Illinois. He is the president of the United States. And we have a competitive and dangerous world he needs to spend his time on and not these issues. Abortion and birth control, education, transportation, funding of police and firefighters. Our president, when he was doing the stimulus bill, appeared before firefighters in Cleveland, Ohio, on the front page of the Washington Post, saying that our stimulus bill is funding these firefighters. This is the president of the United States. The abortion issue is especially instructive. Prior to 1973, U.S. Supreme Court nominees were examined based on their life's work. Ever since Roe v. Wade nationalized what had been a state issue, all the discussions about Supreme Court justice today are simply, are they pro-choice or pro-life? These are vital issues. These are moral and emotional issues. On the national stage, they tear the fabric of the republic because they are binary in nature, and that's why there should be 50 discussions and not one. These national debates make us appear shrill and intolerant before the world. They divide our people and our communities. They detract from the truly national issues before our leaders in Washington. And finally, number four, we conservatives need to conserve the future. We need to involve the next generation of Americans in our work. ISI, the Fund for American Studies, Claremont, the Philadelphia Society, etc., must all double and triple the young people that they involved. I'm delighted, Bill and Julie, we have a lot of young people today. We need to, of course, increase that. Every American campus needs a Madison program like the one that Robert George has built at Princeton University, and on and on. In summary, we must keep the faith, privatize our education, radically renew American federalism, and conserve the future with our young people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. You've already helped us segue from the international to the domestic dimension of our topic.
Thank you very much. Certainly great to be at the Philadelphia Society. Again, I've been here many times for many years, and I also appreciate all the people coming here in the spring. You know, one of the problems I've always had with the Philadelphia Society is that your meeting always takes place in the nicest weekend in the spring, and if there's one thing I hate to do, it's spend the weekend in a hotel on days like we had yesterday and Friday. But nevertheless, here we are. Let me start off with a few observations of things that I heard over the last couple of days and tell you a couple of stories and other things that the way I perceive it. To begin with, it seems to me that it's pretty obvious that we are engaged in a death struggle with the left. It's a worldwide struggle, and I think if you look at what goes on in the world, you can probably almost put everything that we've been talking about into that battle between the right and the left. And very frankly, as Mr. Bybach said, others, the United States really stands for what is right still, even though it's maybe not as clear as it used to be, but the principles of what America stands for are the principles that the left hates and which the left wants to defeat. And frankly, I think a great deal of what is termed anti-Americanism is what has been generated by the left as almost a ruse, because it's a convenient way for them to convince people that the American principles are wrong. And as John said, and I'm going to talk about also, we have really we have forgotten about the things that we can do to correct that. There are certain principles, as Mr. Maybach said also, that I think are clear. He mentioned the piece that I wrote that is in the current issue of the Intercollegiate Review. It was a speech that I gave in February to undergraduates at the Citadel on the foundations of American conservatism. And what I concluded was there were four principles of conservatism, which are really the principles that America was built on. And those are liberty, tradition and order, the rule of law, and belief in God. And I think everything stems from that. And if you look at what anti-Americanism is, it's trying to defeat all of those four things in favor of what the left would have us believe. The left is relentless in the use of propaganda. It's something they learned in the 1920s when communism was first emerging. Propaganda, disinformation, misinformation, all of those other things that they did. They still use the same tactics. They've learned it extremely well, and much of what passes for legitimate information is actually disinformation or propaganda, which they have generated. And I think if you look at what goes on in the world in terms of anti-Americanism, much of it stems from that use of propaganda. They have no hesitation to use deception, lies, as I say, disinformation, which is a very interesting principle, that is planting something that is somewhat untrue, but which makes their point, and which, if you look at it, follow it, it'll eventually emerge on the front page of the New York Times as if it were true. And you can often trace those things back to something that was planted in some small newspaper someplace that somebody didn't check on the facts, and it becomes the conventional wisdom. When Ronald Reagan arrived in Hollywood in 1947, you remember that he was involved in a dispute with the unions over jurisdiction, and he looked at it and he said it really wasn't about jurisdiction at all. As he said, Joseph Stalin had set out to make Hollywood an instrument of propaganda for his program of Soviet expansionism aimed at communizing the world. Those are Ronald Reagan's words. And I think the same thing goes on today. It may be more subtle than what Stalin was doing then, but it still certainly exists. Richard Pipes yesterday said that most people in the world are not anti-American, and that has been repeated several times, and I think it's absolutely true. The old line is in across the world, Yankee, go home, but take me with you. And they all believe that. I remember one time I was traveling in Syria. I spent a couple of weeks there in 2001, and the Syrian people are enormously friendly. You could run into them on the street and cafes. I was a tourist, and they were just overwhelmingly friendly. And the conversation always went something like this. So you're an American. Well, I don't like your government very much, but then, you know, I don't like our government very much either. And so I assume that you said, I can't do anything about our government, and I assume you can't do anything about your government, so let's be friends. And that, I think the same conversation came up again and again and again, and I think it characterized the way so many people in the world think about Americans. So what are we going to do about it? Well, as a domestic thing, there's one thing that everybody in this room can help do, and I would suggest that you all drop what you're doing between now and November and help defeat Barack Obama. As has been suggested, this man is a leftist. He is an ideologue. He hates America. He isn't really an American. I mean, we're not going to go there in terms of where he was born, but he doesn't really believe in American ideals, either to the people that work for him. You look at people like David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, his wife, the other people that advise him, and they are as ideologically left as he is. The czars that work for him, the people that he has planted throughout the bureaucracy in Washington, all have the same agenda, and that is to denigrate America wherever they can, and I think a great deal of the anti-Americanism that you see is a result of what's going on. Second, act decisively and boldly in promoting America. America, when